This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know, kids today are facing a serious health threat. Over the past 30 years, childhood obesity rates have more than doubled. Today, according to the American Obesity Association, more than 30% of kids and teens aged 6 to 19 are overweight, and more than 15% of those are obese. And when kids are overweight, they're susceptible to a host of chronic diseases that afflict adults. Diseases like type 2 diabetes, elevated cholesterol, high blood pressure. So how do you fight this growing epidemic? Well, a new report out this week from the National Academies Institute of Medicine says it's not enough for kids to make lifestyle changes. That's not going to do it. Schools, communities, restaurants, and other institutions need to take some responsibility and make changes to help kids adopt a healthier lifestyle. And some of the report's recommendations include having restaurants and schools make their meals healthier, having schools and communities guarantee that kids get enough exercise, and stopping the marketing of unhealthy foods to kids. Well, some schools and communities are already taking this advice to heart, and today we're broadcasting from San Antonio, Texas, where the problems of these childhood diseases are already being addressed. So this hour, children's health is on the agenda, and we'll talk about the role of schools and community health centers in managing obesity and other chronic diseases in kids. And if you'd like to tell us, maybe your community is doing something, what's happening where you live, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in the audience at the University of Texas Health Science Center, please step up to the mic on the sides of the room, and we'd love to hear your questions. Let me introduce my guests. Autumn Dawn Galbraith is MD, is president of South Texas Asthma Coalition. She's also the director of the University of Texas Disease Management Center and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And nice to have you here. Dr. Henry McGill is a professor of pathology emeritus at the University of Texas Health Science Center and a senior scientist emeritus in the Department of Physiology and Medicine at the Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research here in San Antonio. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. Phyllis Priest is a registered nurse. She's nursing coordinator for the San Antonio Independent School District. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And Dr. Robert Ferry is an assistant professor of pediatrics and of cellular and structural biology and research and training director in the Division of Pediatric Endocrinology and Diabetes at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. Welcome to the program.
Too many titles, Bob. It's fine.
Well,
pleasure to be here.
Bob is good. We'll work with that. Phyllis Priest, tell us, you're a nurse. What is the biggest health problem that you see in schools that's confronting kids all the time?
Well, I would say that probably the biggest problem that we see in schools that impacts their academic achievement is asthma.
Asthma?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then where would the others rate along that?
I think we do know, of course, that obesity is a huge problem. But in terms of, and I think it does impact their academic achievement, mm-hmm. but in terms of a student's attendance and their level of performance in the school, I think asthma would probably have more of an impact. Asthma is usually, when we deal with it in the school setting, it's because mm-hmm. of an acute episode. And I think we're just beginning to learn the impact that possibly obesity is having that is a little bit more subtle and maybe not quite so noticeable.
And Dr. Galbraith, asthma, San Antonio is way up there, isn't it, in the country's rating on asthma?
We are, although asthma has been increasing in incidence nationwide. Actually, the last 2 years, it's kind of plateaued a little bit, which we were glad to see. But nationally speaking, asthma has doubled in incidence in between 1980 and about 2000 or so.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any understanding why that is? Are kids allergic more to something? Is it something in the air? Is it what they're, either eating? Do we have any idea why?
That's the $100 million question. There's a lot of research going on trying to understand that. There are a number of hypotheses, a number of proposed explanations for that. One of them is allergies, and the incidence of allergies has been increasing during this time frame as well. Another is environmental issues. Mm-hmm. Everybody who knows much about asthma is aware that things in the air and things in the home environment can impact a child's health when he has asthma. And as our air becomes more polluted and our environment becomes less friendly to our lungs, that's a potential explanation. And then a third explanation is something that has been termed the hygiene hypothesis, which really proposes that we are too clean and that as we vaccinate our kids and as we insulate our homes and as we avoid dirt and germs in all forms and fashions, our immune systems become hyperreactive to those, and asthma may be one of the results of that process.
In other words, our kids don't get dirty enough, early enough in life to develop an immunity.
Well, you know, there's an old saying, he didn't get his peck of dirt, which is what people my grandparents' age used to say when a kid got sick. And really, the hygiene hypothesis would be a more scientific way of saying that.
Now, Phyllis Parisa, therefore, if so many kids have asthma, I guess the schools have to know how to, if you're a school nurse, you have to know how to cope with this, right?
Asthma is, as far as chronic diseases go, it is the leading cause for children being absent that can be attributed to a chronic disease. And so, of course, we're very concerned about kids that are absent. We want the kids to be in school. And school nurses are in a unique position to be able to assess the children while they're at school and to administer various medications that are ordered by the physician so that the child can remain in school as long as the symptoms are mild and as long as they're responding to the medication. They're also in a unique position to do a lot of patient education, a lot of parent and family education, and to sort of serve as a liaison to kind of choreograph the students' care while they're at school, giving teachers information that they need and helping teachers to understand some of the symptoms the student might experience while they're in the classroom, how asthma might impact their performance academically.
Now, Dr. Ferry, Nurse Parisa said that she sees asthma as the number one problem, but you're into the obesity side of this issue, aren't you?
Yeah, I think, you know, it depends on how you get the numbers. Clearly, asthma is the most common chronic disease in childhood on a per-number basis, but diabetes is a close second. And we used to just worry about type 1 diabetes, where we call it juvenile diabetes. These are children who have an autoimmune disease, destroys their beta cells, and they have to take insulin their whole life. We have 1 in 400 to 500, depending on how you look at the numbers, about 1 million children under the age of 18 with type 1 diabetes. That was bad enough. But now we have type 2 diabetes in kids, and it's about half, depending on where you are in the country, half of the new patients who present with type 2 diabetes under the age of 18. So this is now an epidemic for us, and Dr. Dan Hale, who's our division chief here, was really one of the pioneers in recognizing this trend almost a decade ago and established San Antonio's leading national center for the study and description and treatment of kids with obesity. So we see now numbers that are just staggering, that you really just, you know, I had trouble believing until we did the studies. About a year ago, February of 2003, we went to the Rio Grande Valley to Starr County, which was at that time, according to the statistics from the federal government, the poorest county in the country, where the mean income gross for a family of four was $9,800. Mm. So we're talking about, you know, people who don't have much resources, but great spirit and, you know, great humanity and great family values. And these schools, eight elementary schools there in Rio Grande City, we had 1,207 children enrolled in pre-K and kindergarten. So we're talking about 4 and 5 year olds. We screened about 750 of those children in 4 days, looking at their blood sugar, their heights, their weights, a change on the back of the skin that we call acanthosis nigricans, kind of a tinting that looks like dirt but really isn't. Parents sometimes try and wash it off, and they can't understand why it doesn't wash off, and it's a permanent change in the skin from these high insulin levels from the insulin resistance. So we screened these children. We found that 10% of these 4 and 5 year olds had this acanthosis, which is not normal. 10% of them had sugars that weren't quite right, weren't diabetic levels, but not as low as kids that young should have. And 10% of the children were morbidly overweight, obese, by any national criteria. 2% of the 4-year-olds had hypertension, and 4% of the 5-year-olds had hypertension. So if you cut to the chase, that means 1 out of 3 before they enter first grade are overweight or at risk for diabetes, with the same kind of problems we used to think of in 40, 50-year-olds. That's staggering. So 1 out of 3 before first grade, and it just gets bigger from there, no pun intended. So, you know, what you're dealing with is will be the next asthma. And so when we have kids who are that overweight at that age, and this is representative of many populations across the country. It's not unique to South Texas. There's not something in our water. There's not something in our genes. It's something really in the United States and other developed countries, whereas you go around the world and you see the food portions increasing, the exercise decreasing, you have very hardworking parents. How many parents are both are working their job, you know, both trying to keep the household going? Who's there to walk the kids? You know, who's there to, with the dog and chasing and playing catch and all those things that we sort of take for granted, which we don't anymore because we have video games and other things that distract them. So that's the problem we see. And it's subtle, as she said. It's not something, a little bit of tinting on the back of the neck. And is that acanthosis or is it just kind of, you know, normal skin coloration? Or, you know, is this obesity or is this another disease? It's a big problem.
Dr. McGill, and you've been studying atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, for your whole, almost your whole life, and you now notice the beginning signs of them in our adolescent kids now?
Yeah, that's not my whole life, but my whole professional and research career.
That's about 50 years?
Starting in 1950.
I think that's pretty far, 53 years.
My mentor in New Orleans in 1950 started talking about atherosclerosis being a pediatric problem, and us young folks thought the old boy was crazy. But we did what he told us to do. We looked at arteries from children and young people and found that, indeed, atherosclerosis began in childhood. Then in 1953, along came three Army pathologists that autopsied Korean battle casualties and found an astounding degree of atherosclerosis in their coronary arteries. Now, that caught the attention of everybody. Now, we knew that atherosclerosis began in childhood and that it progressed through adolescence and young adulthood silently. Nobody knew they had it until they dropped dead on the street from a heart attack in their late 30s or 40s, or got a pain in the chest, or had a frank myocardial infarction, went to the hospital. We knew 40 years ago that these heart attacks could be predicted from the risk factors. Everybody knows these now. It's high blood cholesterol, high blood pressure, smoking, obesity that's been talked about, and diabetes. What we did not know at that time, even when the Korean battle casualties were reported, was whether these same risk factors affected the process in children. Well, in the last 10 years, we know now that they do, as a result of a project I've been involved in since 1985. 3,000 young people autopsied in forensic laboratories. We got their arteries and their tissues. And the answer is clear. These risk factors do matter in childhood. They're operating on the arteries in real time. And adolescent smokers, for example, are actually damaging their arteries while they're smoking.
Do you suspect this is just a national problem or a worldwide problem?
National problem and worldwide in the industrialized countries. There are many countries, the undeveloped countries, that don't even know anything about coronary heart disease. They either don't live long enough or they're not exposed to these environmental influences that our children are.
All right. Well, this is sobering news. We're going to talk lots more when we come back from this break about the children's health and possibly some answers that San Antonio is taking maybe can be applied to other parts of the country. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about children's health with my guests, Dr. Autumn Dawn Galbraith, University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, Dr. Henry McGill, Department of Physiology and Medicine and Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research in San Antonio. Phyllis Priest, a registered nurse for the San Antonio Independent School District. And Robert Ferry, also of the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. When we left for the break, we were talking about the development of hardening of the arteries in kids, beginning at a young age in kids. And I want to just clarify it a little bit more with Dr. Henry McGill. So it's not that these young people have heart disease already, but that their arteries are starting to harden. This is leading to heart disease later on in life. What is the progression that you see here?
Yes. They have disease. They just don't know about it. It's totally silent. until one of these plaques that is filled with lipid fat and has a fibrous capsule breaks down and a blood clot forms on it, and then they get a catastrophic occlusion of the coronary artery, and then they either die immediately or have a myocardial infarct or have angina.
Mm-hmm.
These conditions are very well known now from some of our prominent politicians, no respect to the political party.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Cheney had four heart attacks and wears an implantable pacemaker or mm-hmm. defibrillator. And we know about Bill Clinton recently.
Right.
But they didn't know they had this until they had the first heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
So the long-term answer to this is to start back in childhood with control of these risk factors.
Would also medication be an answer to this?
Oh, don't talk about pills for children.
I got to ask. Don't shoot the message. I got to ask the question.
Pills, it's lifestyle, lifestyle, lifestyle.
Okay.
Now, you addressed that in what you read from the recent pronouncement from the National Academy of Sciences,
right,
I believe.
Right, they had a whole list of things to do.
Now, parents can right away start looking to their children's lifestyle. They're fighting an uphill battle, as we know from the culture around
right.
them.
The
right. long-term answer is to change this environment so our children are not tempted with mm-hmm. all of these things around them that cause obesity, cause hypertension, high blood cholesterol, mm-hmm. and smoking.
Mm-hmm. Nurse Priest, I know that there are some schools and some people are trying to take over, right, and do the right thing for the kids?
Right. As far as obesity goes, I think the schools are in a unique position to make a big contribution and to make a big difference, because it's obvious that children spend the better part of their day in the school setting. And also in my district, in particular, all of our children receive both free breakfast and free lunch. So we have the additional opportunity to really literally control about two-thirds, let's say, of their food intake. Because we are on the free lunch program, we follow the very strict guidelines set out by the Department of Agriculture, mm-hmm. which is gradually improving what children see on their cafeteria trays. They're mainly trying to have foods that have more fiber in them, lower fat, and also they're controlling the portion sizes. I think that's a mm-hmm. big part of controlling obesity. It's mandated in the elementary grades that there be, I believe it's 135 minutes of physical activity every week. And so, of course, we do that. But in our district, we have a very good opportunity to even go above and beyond that, because we are very fortunate to have what we call the Bienestar program in our schools. And it's a program that was started by Dr. Robert Trevino. It's been about 3 years ago now, and the high points of that program are that the children that participate they are exposed to a health and physical education curriculum. Their parents are exposed to nutrition education, and the food service workers at the schools where these children attend are also given some additional education as far as how to prepare healthy, attractive meals that children want to eat, and also how to motivate children, hopefully, to make healthy choices.
But do these things work? Are they seeing results on them?
Yes, they are.
They are.
Kids
more exercise, they're losing weight, they're Bob Ferry, as an MD, you see their glucose levels changing on these programs?
In fact, there's a publication from Dr. Hale and Dr. Trevino that just came out last month, September, in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine. And what they showed was that they looked at about 13 interventions and 14 control schools. We're talking about a program that's in several school districts in South Texas. All told, there are over 30,000 children enrolled in these school districts, of which they have selected a group of about 3,000. Mostly mid-elementary school level children, and did an intervention and were able to show a very significant lowering of the blood sugars, as well as an increase in fiber intake and a lower dietary saturated fat intake. So these interventions work. It's not pablum. It's not a medicine. It's cost-effective, community-based intervention, which is culturally appropriate in a place that is very diverse. And I'm talking now about South Texas, but I could just as easily be talking about Los Angeles. In fact, complementary to the Bienestar program is a detection of the acanthosis that we talked about earlier. So what happens when you detect this problem in a child? Where does that child get referred to, particularly if they may not have medical resources? So the university here works very closely with these community-based programs, and we act as a referral base into our TODAY study, which is treatment options in diabetic adolescents and youth, funded by the NIH, 12 centers at major urban cities around the country. These children, as they get detected, are pulled into a treatment regimen which includes behavior and, if necessary, medication, because there are times when you have to give medication. So that is really a tremendous way for all of these resources, these system levels, to work together for the benefit of the individual child.
Let me go to Dr. Galbraith, and then I'll go out and get a question here.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject that we're talking about these diseases in sort of a silo fashion, as if obesity and asthma and coronary artery disease were three separate problems. And in some ways they are, and yet there's a lot of overlap. There is a statistical correlation between kids with obesity and kids with asthma, so that a child with asthma is more likely to be obese and vice versa. There are risk factors that predispose kids to all three of these things. Low socioeconomic status being one that puts a child at risk for all three of these illnesses, as well as diabetes. And really what it boils down to is what Dr. McGill said earlier, which is lifestyle changes. Our bodies weren't created to eat potato chips and sit in front of the TV. And since our lifestyle has changed so much in the last 50 years, we're seeing the impact of that on our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a woman out here. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
I'd like to know how to handle it when parents say that a fat baby is a healthy baby and there's nothing wrong with my toddler, they're going to lose weight when they get to school, and as long as they're active and happy, I don't care what they weigh.
Can I jump in?
Dr. Galbraith, go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I think that one of the cornerstones to everything that we're talking about here today is education. And you just painted a great picture of the problems that we face culturally in South Texas, but everywhere. And really, we have to continue to reiterate over and over and over and over and over until we feel like we can't say it again, and then we have to say it again. Because parents and lay people don't approach these problems in the same way that science does. So education is a critical cornerstone to remedying all of these problems.
Dr. McGill, did you want to say something?
Lots of evidence that these risk factors track from childhood into adulthood. Fat kids stay fat. Kids with high blood cholesterol still have high blood cholesterol. High blood pressure.
Well, could this not be genetic, the genetic side of some of this?
Oh, yes, there's a genetic factor, but our genetics haven't changed in the last 50 years. It's the environment that's changed. Mm-hmm. There are kids with genetically determined high blood cholesterol. They're the ones that do need the pills.
I gotcha.
And there are several reports recently that the statins are very effective in these kids with what's called familial hypercholesterolemia. Mm-hmm. Fairly safe, too.
You were talking about this as a cultural, crossing all cultural areas. We've seen cultural campaigns for drinking milk, We've seen cultural campaigns for all kinds of, don't drink and drive aimed at kids, don't take drugs. Why don't we have something nationally for kids to eat correctly? We don't have, where are the rock stars who, the icons for kids? We've had them for all these other things. There are no icons anywhere for kids to eat and exercise. Why aren't there? I'm not going to ask should there be, because I think you probably all agree, Dr. Galbraith, but are you, and I guess this boils down to, are you fighting these battles in the trenches in the local communities? Is that where you're fighting them and then where you're paying for them and you don't get really much help anywhere above this in the state or in the national level, the nurse priest?
I guess, when you deny children the food that they want to eat, that is somewhat of an unpopular place to be. Although I think we need to be very, we need to be more creative in our approaches. And because, You know, I think that when kids are provided with a lot of healthy choices, and really this is the premise of the Department of Agriculture, it's not so much that a child can't have a candy bar, or they can't have a soda. It's that first, you know, all of the healthy choices need to be provided, and the child needs to eat those things, and then after the fact, you know, the candy bar might be okay, or the mm-hmm. occasional soda might be okay. And so, like Dr. Galbraith said, it's just very important to educate, and we have to, different people learn different ways. We just have to keep saying it over and over and say it in different ways and
get out and play.
Yes, yes. It's not...
Shut off that TV.
It doesn't have to be complicated. Right.
Can you pull out that video game? Mm-hmm. Dr. McGill.
You've got to remember that these changes represent literally a cultural revolution that affect agriculture, food processing, the tobacco industry.
There are some people who swear you can draw a graph between corn syrup production and the health of kids these
because
days.
Because that's used in flavoring the soda pop that has been vended in schools to raise money, a sleazy way to support our public education.
Mm-hmm.
But think of the other things that have happened. Look what happened to cigarette smoking in the 1960s when the Surgeon General's report came out. 62% of adults were smoking. The latest figures I saw a week ago were 24% of adults. What's scary, though, is that 22% of high school students are still smoking.
That is scary.
And that's scary.
Yeah. Dr. Galper?
I was just going to say, going back to your point about national efforts, the CDC really has begun to focus on these issues. And the Healthy People 2010 document, which is published by the CDC, really starts to focus on some of these chronic diseases in kids and on preventive measures. So there are some activities going on at a national level, but the place where the education has to happen ultimately is in the schools, in the doctor's offices, in the communities, in the community centers. And so those are the types of things that we're trying to work on here in our local community as a complement to the national effort.
As a grassroots effort, but as Dr. McGill pointed out, you know, there was the Surgeon General coming out with a report that was, it may not have stopped people from smoking by putting that warning on the label on the cigarette packs, but it got the national consciousness raised to where, you know, the number of people smoking came down, and they had all kinds of people thinking about it. You need something like that with obesity, I would think. You know, Dr. Ferry?
It comes down to making good choices, and that happens with the dietitian, with the school lunch program. It happens with the parents who are making unlimited time making the meals at home. How do you get those resources in? That's what the Today study is about. So, for example, in our own institution, Peggy Vicio, one of the dietitians on our faculty, has done low-fat meal makeovers on our website. There's a PowerPoint presentation you can download, and it shows the typical meal, you know, the hamburger and the supersized fries and the super shake and so forth, and how do you turn that into something healthy? How do you cut the food portions down? How do you replace regular sodas with a diet soda? And this is not we don't receive any money from any of these companies, but there are now beginning to be some changes in the institutions that make foods to make healthy alternatives. So, for example, we now have a sugar substitute that you can cook with called Splenda that is generally very well received. And we have a recognition that we need to replace some of these regular soft drinks with diet soft drinks. So that education, whether it's dietary-based with PowerPoint slides, giving that to school nurses and lots of talks that we give in the schools about how to make a school lunch program the healthiest they can be, training parents with our cooking classes. We have at the Texas Diabetes Institute where I practice, we have a gym 15 feet from where I see patients. Okay, so if I need to prescribe exercise for an adolescent but they can't afford it, here's a gym that's $15 a month that's right next to where we take care of patients. We also have on the second floor cooking classes that we invite the community to come into and enjoy. So you provide those resources to the people making those decisions.
We're talking about child health this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let me go to this side of the room, get a question. Yes, sir.
As a child psychologist, I'm seeing a lot of kids with depression and anxiety that with a high percentage of medical problems like asthma, like high blood pressure, like sleep disorders. And I wonder, is this coincidence, or in your research and experience, are you finding a lot of these kids that also have concurrent mental health problems as well?
Yeah, that's a major problem, actually. And we, just in the context of an investigator, I review grants for NIH, and we're starting to see those applications from pediatric investigators looking at these comorbidities. No question that there's a comorbidity of depression with diabetes, whether that's type 1 diabetes or type 2. Some people think that what happens is that when you're insulin resistant, one of the things that doesn't happen is you don't get a normal satiety signal. You don't get the sense that you're hungry when you're supposed to get it. And if you're not getting the insulin to your brain to tell you that you're not hungry, you may also not be getting the calories into your brain that maybe would make you feel a little better. So part of being overweight, part of being diabetic, can often be the sort of mild crabbiness or something that's actually frank depression. And it's understudied, particularly in children, and this is because we have a couple of problems. There aren't that many pediatric investigators. We're trying very hard, many folks in many subdisciplines of pediatrics, to get more pediatric investigators trained, actually on the ground, doing the work that needs to be done to evaluate these kinds of problems. No question that's a real issue. We don't have any FDA approvals for drugs that are used in adults. We don't want to over-medicate. That's clearly an issue in children, that we don't want polypharmacy that would be not necessary. We don't want pills when family counseling may be in a more appropriate modality. Mm-hmm. So your point is very well taken.
Quickly before the break, yes, in the audience.
Hi, as a parent of a child with very mild asthma, her school district is so concerned about the increase in asthmatic attacks that they've instituted a policy where children with any diagnosis, be it mild or severe, need to stay inside during recess and they can't participate in outdoor PE. And I guess I'd like the nurse from SAISD to tell me if their district also follows this policy, and how do you weigh the balances between someone with, a mild problem, trying to get the exercise, and then they are allowed if they have waivers from physicians, but then you get liability.
I have 40 seconds, Nurse Priest. You can answer that, and then we'll come back and do the big answer after the break.
Okay. In my district, the way we handle that is if it is an ozone alert day, we keep the children in that are experiencing moderate to severe symptoms. That's our policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a quick answer. But I know Dr. Galbraith wants to talk more about it. So we're going to come back and talk more with Dr. Ferry, Dr. McGill, Dr. Galbraith, and Nurse Priest. After this break, stay with us. We'll be right back more with childhood, adolescence, and health. I'm Ira Flato. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about children's health. And we're here in San Antonio, Texas, with my guests, Autumn Dawn Galbraith, a physician at University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, Dr. Henry McGill of the Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research in San Antonio. I understand it's your birthday today, Dr. McGill.
Hey.
Happy birthday to you.
Thanks.
Should I ask how old you are?
No.
Okay. Keep my customers satisfied. Phyllis Priest is a registered nurse and nursing coordinator for the San Antonio Independent School District. And Bob Ferry, a physician at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. Before we went to the break, we were talking about how to deal with children who have asthma in the schools. How do you deal with them, Dr. Galbraith?
Well, you heard me groan when the question was asked. because not only is keeping all kids with all asthma inside from recess all the time, which is what I think the caller said, not only is that not the standard practice in schools, but in fact it's directly contradictory to the national guidelines for managing asthma. One of the stated goals of appropriate asthma management is that kids with asthma would be able to participate in all activities equivalent to any other kid their age. And by keeping kids in from recess and gym, which has been a mechanism that has been used by parents and people in the past, we are in fact increasing their likelihood of becoming obese and experiencing all of these other chronic diseases that we've been talking about today. So that wouldn't be a mechanism that we would recommend, but in fact, making sure that the kids are doing activity that's appropriate and making sure that the educators, particularly the coaches and PE teachers, are aware of warning signs for asthma so that you can have a kid out playing, but when the kid starts to have problems, the school staff and the child himself know exactly what to do and when is enough and what they need to do next.
You're studying how best to manage asthma in San Antonio, not only for kids but for adults. Let's talk about specifics. What are some some of the things you're doing to get asthma treatment to underserved populations?
We've summarized our study really well. We are, in fact, not looking for a new treatment for asthma, but we are trying to take the effective therapies which already exist and figure out the best mechanism for getting them into the hands of the many, many underserved patients who don't have access to them. So our study is actually enrolling about 1,100 kids and adults with asthma in not just San Antonio, but South and Central Texas. And we are studying three different approaches to getting those medications and lifestyle changes and education materials into the homes and lives of those families. So we are educating the parents. We are working with school nurses. We're doing home visits to assess the home environment to look for asthma triggers, making recommendations that the families can follow up with to try to reduce those asthma triggers. And then importantly for the pediatric patients, we're educating the kids themselves. And I think that that's a step that we miss sometimes in the healthcare system. We are so accustomed to talking with the parents that we forget to say, hey, here's what you should do when you're out at recess and you need help.
Let's go to the phones to Paw Paw, Michigan. Spencer, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there, go ahead.
I am actually a 14-year-old. I am in a physical education program at a public high school right now. And I was sort of curious when I heard this program come on today, because something that I notice a lot when I'm at school in gym class is that physical activity, a lot of the stuff we do, it's sort of treated almost as a sort of chore.
It's something that
we have to do and we should do that's very rote, instead of getting outside and just doing some sort of physical activity.
Of your own choosing.
Push-ups, sit-ups, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I was curious what sort of programs are underway across the nation, in schools especially, but also in communities, to help alleviate that.
Well, any good suggestions? Nurse Phyllis?
While I'm not a physical education teacher, I'm working in the school setting, I will tell you that I'm not sure how it is in Michigan, but I know in the state of Texas, physical education is just like any other course. There is a set curriculum that the teacher has to teach, and there are certain objectives that have to be met by the student. And I'm not really sure how much leeway the instructor has as far as the activities that the child would participate in helping them to meet those objectives. I agree with you that exercise should be fun, and if it's not, most people aren't going to do it, and there needs to be a variety of activities so that if people don't get bored. That's not unique to children. That's the same mm-hmm. for adults.
Mm-hmm. So thanks for calling, Spencer. You're not only that, but you have a situation where if you have kids who are out of shape and overweight, they never want to get into gym clothes and be seen by their other peers. You know, that's the double problem here.
And they're the last kid picked for the team. It's multiple aspects to it.
So they're not going to want to go to gym class. They're not going to want to participate. They're going to want to hide, you know. Dr. Ferry, there's more going on here that needs to be addressed than just say, let's have some more physical
activity. But there are still fun things to do. So we do a summer camp every year, and we've started to now focus on type 2 diabetes in that summer camp. And, I focus on the ings, playing, chasing the dog, running, swimming, dancing. There are lots of ings you can do. You just have to pick the ing you like. And everybody's a little bit different in that. Some people like to walk and chat and talk and gossip, and they can do that when they're walking.
And you may have to do this outside of school.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Not
and I think after school, and you have to, I think you said, well, there are a lot of limitations. There's also, there have to be ways to find that freedom. You have to find ways to incorporate new activities, that new sports, maybe do a project.
And how much are parents at fault for some of their kids not doing these things?
I don't know if it's at fault. We like to blame people in society, like there's always somebody to blame. At the end of the day, it's what you expect of yourself, not what you expect of someone else. And I think, parents have a lot of obligations. There's no question that people are working harder, getting home tireder. So what do you do when you don't have the energy to make the meal and then go for a walk? Well, you could buy a puppy and chase the puppy. You could find ways to walk together in a mall. So if it's air conditioned and you're in a hot place, or it's heated in a cold place, you can do something together and still get out and be social, and do that perhaps in a crowd where you don't feel like you're the only person on the track at 5:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah, Phyllis Preet.
I think the Bienestar program did an excellent job of addressing fun physical activities for not only the child but the child and the family.
their after-school program where they presented some of the physical education and health activities that were over and above what other children get were a lot of fun activities. And when they brought the parents in, they did salsa dancing and things like that. And one of the findings of the study was that the physical fitness level of the children did improve.
Hmm. Let's go to the microphone right there, sir. Yes.
To what extent does the high rate of uninsured school children here in Texas have on the health problems in children you have discussed?
Dr. Galbraith?
You've hit on one of the really critical components to this whole puzzle.
Tell the rest of the country what he's implying.
Well, I'll say that Texas has a 20%. 20% of the children in Texas are uninsured. Although, in our defense, I will say that there are many other states that are in double digits in uninsured children. We unfortunately lead the pack at the moment. But uninsured children can't see a doctor easily. Uninsured children can't get a hold of the medication that they need, particularly for asthma or diabetes, easily. Uninsured children tend to be in that socioeconomic bracket where they're at higher risk for these diseases anyway. They tend to have two parents working. They tend to be eating McDonald's. They tend to be sitting in front of the TV because they might not live in a neighborhood that's safe. So it's a huge social problem, and it definitely dramatically impacts on the ability to control all of these diseases. And that's a part of why our study is focusing on that very population, uninsured and underserved. So that would include Medicaid, CHIP, type kids as well, to try to see what works for them, because they're different.
20% of the kids in Texas
are uninsured completely.
Huh. Let's go to this woman over here. Yes.
Okay, I am a mother of two children. I would consider myself well-educated. I have put my children on healthy diets. I limit their TV. I limit their computer to half an hour a day. And yet, in San Antonio, I'm finding it very difficult to exercise my children. You can enroll them in competitive leagues where they're spending 11 months of their life in competitive sports, and a lot of children don't want to do that, especially obese children. What my question is what is it about Texas, what is it about San Antonio, that there are so few playgrounds, so few places where the children can have neighborhood sports? When I was in Pittsburgh, we lived in Pittsburgh, we had three playgrounds within walking distance of our house. And we had all the neighborhoods had their soccer teams, the football teams, the kids would join with the neighborhood team, play with each other. You know, you as educators are saying, educate the parents. I'm educated.
All right, well, we're going to run out of time. I'd like to educate you some more, get an answer. We're talking about obesity this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And Dr. Ferry wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I just want to make the point that a community is defined by what the people in the community do. And when we have a community that's very car-driven, when we're not walking together, we don't take that time to sit down and talk to our neighbor in a neighborhood park, in a neighborhood community center. If you have to drive to a community center in order to have an activity, that makes it more difficult. So we do have infrastructure. I cycle a fair amount, and we don't necessarily have the most cycle-friendly roads in San Antonio. We have a fair amount of sort of some nails and stuff that, you know, I have to fix my tire a lot as compared to other places that I've ridden my bike. But I can still ride my bike. It just takes more effort. And other communities which also have problems with infrastructure, we talked a little bit about Starr County, where they just don't have a lot of a tax base to support the building of the parks and so forth, they have to really be community-driven. So I think what you can do is, as a parent and a concerned parent, is get up in city council meetings, get up in local PTA meetings, and say, how do we take what resources we have and put them to the best benefit of our children and build the parks that need to be built? Or how do we get carpools together to get kids to, say, the Barshop Community Center here in San Antonio, which has a fabulous, you know, pool and resources and a chess club every week and lots of ways for kids and adults to be healthy. So those resources are there, but they're often hard to get to. You know, I was in Japan, and I'll finish with this, about a year and a half ago, and I didn't drive a car for almost a week because I had fantastic trains to take me everywhere I needed to go, and I spent most of my time walking, and I think I lost some weight because I was walking everywhere. I wish I could walk the 10 miles from my office to my clinic, but I can't, so I have to drive.
Dr. McGill?
My limited experience in politics has taught me that people in a community get exactly what they deserve based on how they vote, how well educated they become when they vote and whom they vote for.
This is the right season, then, to express your opinion and influence the direction of those parks in town, is what you're saying. Okay. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests for joining me this hour. Autumn, Don Galbraith is president of the South Texas Asthma Coalition, director of the University of Texas Disease Management Center, and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. Thank you for taking time to be with us
today, Absolutely.
Dr. Galbraith.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Henry McGill is professor of pathology emeritus at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio and senior scientist emeritus in the Department of Physiology and Medicine at the Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research in San Antonio. Happy birthday to you again today.
Thank you.
And thank you for taking time to talk with us. Phyllis Priest is a registered nurse, an MSN. She's nursing coordinator for the San Antonio Independent School District. Good luck for you, to you, and I wish you well in, you know, making sure these kids have the attention. How many, are there enough nurses in each one of the schools in town here?
Well, no, we wish we had more. We would like to have a licensed nurse on every campus, and we don't at this point, but that's what we're working toward.
Yeah,
it's just, again, a matter of money.
It's election season.
Money and priorities.
Okay, well, we'll try to change that. Robert Ferry, Dr. Ferry, is assistant professor of pediatrics and cellular and structural biology and research and training director in the Division of Pediatric Endocrinology and Diabetes at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. Thank you, Bob.
My pleasure.
For being with us here today. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our studio engineers are Kimberly Jones and Andy Rosenberg here in San Antonio, Cal Southworth, Vince Muse, Gary Henderson, Neil Ellis in Washington. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. And then once again, special thanks today to Janet Grogene and the folks at Texas Public Radio for their help in sponsoring our broadcast. Also thanks to Harcourt Assessment, Keystone School, and DPT, and the University of Texas Health Science Center for helping us make this broadcast possible. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. And if you missed anything we talked about today, you can surf over to our website. Charles will have all that stuff up there by next week. Certainly what we have today, all kinds of links are up there. Also, you can download past editions of Science Friday on your Audible or your iPod, and also back editions, you can listen to them on Real Audio. And also Science Friday's Kids Connection is there, and you get free curricula based on what we do on Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week back in New York. I'm Ira Flato in San Antonio.